Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to episode 136 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Earlier this year, James and Jennifer Crumbly were both convicted, in separate trials, of involuntary manslaughter. Back in 2021, their son, then 15, shot and killed four students in his Michigan high school. Six more students and a faculty member were wounded, and he is serving a life sentence with no possibility of parole. The Crumblies were accused of failing to take critical steps, including safely securing a gun at home, that could have prevented their son's attack. They'll be sentenced for their crimes later this month. Rick, in the wake of this verdict, the New York Times asked a group of teens whether parents should ever be held responsible for the harmful actions of their children, and, if so, under what circumstances. I think we both found their answers fascinating, and I thought we'd explore them more in detail in a moment. But first, what are your thoughts surrounding this very difficult issue?
The thing that stands out to me most is like the difference between the demands of finding legal responsibility versus ethical responsibility, because in case of legal responsibility, the jury is asked to return a verdict of guilty or not guilty, but the very essence of parenting is that responsibility is shared with children, that that when children are very young, for example, an infant, parents have almost, well, they have complete responsibility,
yeah, yeah.
Right? And then gradually children get more and more, but like during the whole time until the child becomes an adult, responsibility is shared with kind of a greater amount being given gradually to the child over time. And so there's that issue of shared responsibility. And then in a way, kind of partial responsibility, there are things that I guess parents that I might be partially responsible for, but it's not clear whether just guilty or not guilty. I mean, I can think of several things at times, like when our children have grown up where they did something that I feel somewhat guilty about, right? About some bad action that they did, and yet it's not really clear that I was in a position to do anything about it. So parenting, I mean, is really complex in a way that the law can't possibly reflect.
And I just want to stick on that for a moment. You know, I'm sure your kids weren't perfect growing up, but I assume that they did a lot of good things as you know, kids, teenagers, and now as adults. And I'd be really surprised if somebody who knows your family well did it say to you, Rick, your son or your sons are just terrific young adults. You should be really proud of them. And in effect, they're saying that you should take some credit for the people they've turned out to be. How do you feel when you get told that?
Well, I feel good about it, and I actually do feel proud. I mean, this is like really like the greatest reward of parenting is seeing your child move into maturity, become like fully functioning adults and contributing members of society. And that's when you feel you've really done your job. Not just that you got them through childhood safely, but you got them like successfully into maturity. It's a really wonderful feeling, the point at which you say, like, yeah, my child's really grown up now. And that kind of happens in stages. I mean, there are times where you feel like, yeah, like that's happening. And then at some point, yeah, they're completely their own person now.
And just to go back again to this case with this Michigan couple that was found, you know, criminally responsible. And obviously there's no ethical trial here, but I would imagine that same jury would hold them ethically responsible, likely too, for the actions of their then 15-year-old son. I mean, it's hard, of course, you know, neither of us followed this case extraordinarily closely, but it seems to me that there are sort of two parts to this, is that there's the one part where, you know, they may have missed some signs about this child's emotional state, could have maybe gotten him some more professional help at particular times along the way, and there could have been some red flags that they missed. That's sort of one half of the equation, and I think that's a little bit of a tougher discussion to have. The other part of it was the gun, right? And yeah, maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
In some ways, this makes us not an ideal case for talking about the broad issue of parental responsibility, because it happens in the context of a school shooting, and there's really strong feelings about this, and that's another debate, really, in to what extent is society itself, like, responsible for regulating ownership and use of guns, right? And so that's something we've talked about before in this.
Sure, but in this case, though, that I think it was the mother, is that right, gave the child a firearm.
Yeah, well, the parents, okay. I think they did this together.
Okay.
The father purchased it, it looks like.
But, okay.
Like, the parents gave the firearm to their son as an early Christmas present. It's pretty clear that what really weighed heavily in the jury's mind was that the son was undergoing some mental distress at the time that they either knew about or should have known about, because there was clear signs of it, that they ignored this, that they ignored his pleas for help, that they didn't secure the gun. Like, and this is something that, like, all parents, I'm not opposed to parents giving minor children firearms, and in fact, I've done this for my own children for hunting. But you have a responsibility then to secure them in the household, and to especially to know where they are, right? And they didn't do either of those things. They did not know that he had taken a handgun to school, and they had not secured it in a safe. And then finally, they had clear warning from school administrators that he was drawing pictures of shooting classmates, and they dismissed these warnings. And so there were all kinds of signs of gross negligence in this particular case.
As I mentioned at the start of the show, and there's been a lot written about this, and you can read sort of the details of the case pretty easily on lots of different news sites, but the New York Times took a bit of a different approach. They talked to some teens who were not, again, to be clear, not at this school, and were not directly affected, and certainly didn't know this family personally, but just sort of wanted to talk to them and what their opinions were about how responsible parents are for the actions of their children. We'll certainly link to that reporting and those that Q&A in the show notes. But just to start off with, many students argued that while it's their parents' job to teach them right from wrong, ultimately, they are responsible for their children's behavior. And the Times piece starts off with, I think, a decent analogy, saying that if a student fails a test, do you blame the student or do you blame the teacher? And typically, we blame the student. And in this case, I think this teen was arguing that that's probably where the blame belongs. Yeah, I mean, we've all had teachers that aren't as good as they could be, but clearly, it's the student's job to know the material. Does that analogy sort of make sense to you?
Yes, as long as the teacher is doing a good enough job for an ordinary student to learn the basic material. So, of course, this is another case with teachers and students of shared responsibility, where they both contribute to an outcome, mm-hmm. right? We've seen cases, and we can easily imagine cases of teachers that were negligent in their duties, and instead of teaching kids the subject, didn't teach them anything at all. In fact, I had a teacher like that in one school for Spanish, and you know, didn't learn anything. And that's that wasn't my fault for not learning Spanish. Not that I was really keen on it, but nobody in the class learned anything because we weren't taught it. But overall, it's a good analogy in that we assume most of the time the teachers are doing a good enough job, and then it's up to the students whether they want to learn or not. And I think in many cases, especially as children get older, we give them more and more of responsibility for the outcomes of their actions.
I've said this before in the show, and I'll just say it here for those who don't know that Rick's raised two sons. I have not had children, so I'm going to lean on him for some of this advice a little more as well. But you had mentioned early on that as children grow older, I mean, again, if you have a six-month-old, the parent's like responsible for every, you know, part of that child's well-being. Because a six-month-old can barely, you know, do anything. And when you're 16, that's a little different. And so as they grow, and again, as we've said before, not all 14-year-olds are the same. Some have a much higher level of maturity and some don't. But also, it seems like when we were kids, that as we grew older, we also spent more time outside the home, be it at school, be it around other friends, and the influence of those people increased, and in some ways the influence of our parents and other family members decreased. I think that's somewhat true today, but of course what's very different today is that the amount of or the type of influences outside the home aren't just other friends or classmates at school, but it's the, well, whatever the kids are stumbling across online, and that's got to make this even tougher.
Yeah, I think parenting has become much tougher for that reason. And we know it's something that we've talked about a bit on this show before, is that the fact that children are maturing more slowly, and that comes about because they are doing less activities outside the home. They're taking responsibility later on for many of the things the sorts of things that we used to have responsibility for doing early on, like starting work later.
Mm-hmm.
Well, work is something where, for many kids, this is something where they assume serious responsibilities that they just didn't have in their life before, right? And so these are things that make you grow up faster. And so things are changing somewhat, and yet it's a matter of degree, and it will change from one child to another. And one of the most challenging things about parenting is trying to make these judgment calls, like when do you give more freedom, and then with that freedom, more responsibility to your children? When do you hold more authority for decisions to yourself because you judge that they aren't ready for it? It's hard to get that exactly right, but it's part of good parenting is that you're making these small decisions over and over. This is one of the things that we can't see about the Crumblies, for example, is like how did they make all these, you know, thousands of little decisions day by day all throughout their son's life? And we just have no insight into that at all.
And I would also think, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, but if you're dealing with a five-year-old child, they might think they're keeping things from you or trying to say one thing but do the other. But they're, I think, in most cases, fairly transparent, that you can tell that what's really going on, and it doesn't take a parenting expert to figure that out. But I would also think as kids get older, they're tougher to read, and that they are, and that's something that some of the teens in the Times piece pointed out, is that parents can't possibly know everything their children are going through. And one teenager even says about how good other teens are at hiding their emotions, especially to their parents, but probably to others as well. And you think about this family in Michigan, and gosh, I can't imagine they thought everything was perfectly well with their child, but clearly they had no idea that, well, what he was about to do. So, it sure must be tough to know whether you just have kind of a broody, moody teen or a teenager who has some serious problems.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult, and just about every teenager will tell you that they hide things from the parents, and probably a lot more than the parents realize. In fact, this is a really interesting thing to do when your children get older, as mine are now. Mm. Ask them, like, what are some things you did that I had no idea about? And they'll just come up with stories.
Really?
I can't believe you did that. Like, yeah, things that we just weren't aware of.
And maybe you could share how old they are today.
Yeah, one's in mid-20s and early 30s. Yeah.
So when you hear these things, I mean, I'm
sure there are still things that they aren't telling us.
There might be. But, like, they obviously, I mean, and I'm sure we're clear, we want to be very clear, that it was nothing even remotely close to what the situation we're talking about here. But, like, I know a friend of mine, and I'll talk about this, well, probably doesn't matter, but I'll talk about it fairly generically. But there, when he was, like, in high school, there was a house for sale across the street, and it had been on the market for a while. And one day, he and some friends got access to inside the home through a big beer party there and left. And then the next day or two, the real estate agent came in and found all the... And I don't think the house was it. There was some... I'm sure a cleaning crew had to probably come in and make it presentable again. I don't think they, you know, they did not make... They didn't have to tear the house down, I want to be clear. But, like, he never told his parents, and, like, mm-hmm. and they're both deceased now, but he, you know, had plenty of chances as an adult to tell them. So there are certain things that you just never, because they would occasionally bring that up. Oh, remember the time when the Johnson's house, and he would just sort of sit there quietly. So it's interesting that your kids are starting to at least carefully tell you these things. So I guess when you hear these things, you're not angry at this point, right?
Oh, no, and I can't even remember any incidents now. I just remember having this discussion of, you know, what was actually going on in their lives and what we knew about. It mm-hmm. was just the difference. Like, they had very different perceptions of that. And it just caused me to think, well, yeah, that's true in my life, too. There's a whole bunch of things in my life when I was a teenager that, you know, I just wouldn't even thought of talking to my parents about, you know. So, like, like teenagers have their life, their parents have access to some of it, some insights. There's other things they don't know. And then, of course, with some children and some parents and children, there might be more transparency, more discussion of what's going on, and with others there aren't. And I remember, like, even my mom and my dad, I would share all kinds of things with my mom that I would never talk to my dad about, mm-hmm. right? Because you have different kinds of relationships. Yeah. This is really important part about parenting, is establishing a kind of relationship early on, so at least the really important, really serious things you'd know about, that your children feel free, and not just free to come to you, but even, like, they want to come to you when they're really troubled about something. And it seems pretty clear, like, at least from things that the son said in the Crumley's case, that he had appealed to them for help with his mental anxieties, but, like, they just didn't want to listen to it. And so who knows if what actually happened there, or what those discussions were like. I mean, we're looking at news stories which just give you, you know, just a sliver of things, but it sounds like they didn't have the kind of relationship to know. And this is the thing about responsibility, because we're talking about what is the parent's responsibility. You're responsible not just for what you know, but what you ought to know, right?
Well, and then staying on that point for a second, and we'll give our listeners a bit of a preview to our next show that we'll be talking about, sort of the right to privacy. But you just mentioned that the parents have, in some cases, a responsibility to know about some things that's going on in their children's lives. Do you think that a high school student living at home has a significant right to a private life that their parents don't or should not have a right to know about?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Like, because, I mean, with cell phones, you know, you can track kids now, which you couldn't do at one time. Sometimes you can, you know, depending on settings and all sorts of preferences on computers, you may be able to go in and look back at browsing history and all sorts of things. And I think some parents feel very comfortable doing that, and some parents feel absolutely not comfortable doing that.
Well, I'll go back to what I said earlier about one of the main tasks of parenting is not just to raise children safely, but to bring them into maturity. And one of the main things we need as mature adults is the ability to trust and to be trusted, to be able to live the kind of life in which we keep some things to ourselves, but we share other things. We know what is appropriate, and we're able to develop the kind of good and relationships, kind of negotiating the difference between what we keep to ourselves and what we share. I don't see how you do that if you're constantly monitoring or tracking everything that your child does. So you have to gradually give them a kind of right to privacy, a right to their own life where they make decisions about it, while also kind of keeping track on them to make sure that they don't do anything with that freedom that harms themselves or others. And this is why it's so important. These parents are going to give their child a gun, it's their responsibility to make sure that their child, first of all, is mature enough and emotionally stable enough not to hurt anybody with it, but then also to ensure that the worst doesn't happen by keeping it locked up. And they just seem to be oblivious to that concern, right? And that's just negligent. So I don't think that parents need to track every movement of their child and all of their online activity. I think that doesn't prepare them well for adulthood, and it also doesn't help to establish the kind of relationship you need with them to have a good relationship later on when they become adults.
In talking to the teens in the Times piece, there were one student at least argued that although the parents may deserve some of the blame, the real perpetrators is the gun industry and the politicians who allow the industry to have unchecked influence. And, you know, we unfortunately in this country have way too many mass shooting incidents, whether they're in schools or other places. And there, every time we have one of these will come up, there is this bubbling up of, you know, gun control questions, which we've certainly talked about on this show before. And in this case, of course, you know, the parental responsibility, because it was a 15-year-old who did the shooting. How do you balance, between, you know, the 15-year-old's responsibility, the parents' responsibility, and, oh, by the way, a gun industry, and I would even expand it a little further, that a culture in this country that in many parts of our society promotes a culture that sort of glamorizes guns and their use, and I guess how would you say that all fits together in sort of this layering of responsibility?
Layering is a good way to put it, because kind of spheres of responsibility are frequently overlapping, and this is a clear case where there's multiple layers of responsibility. One way of parsing this is thinking about both ability and knowledge. And so here is the son, was it Ethan?
Yes.
Ethan Crumbly, who did the shooting. He both had ability, clearly, and he had knowledge of what he was doing. So he had responsibility. The parents had ability because they chose to give their son a handgun, but they could also have secured it. So they had ability there. And then they had, on the morning of the shooting, you know, they had ability to do something, and they chose not to. They also had knowledge, or they at least should have had knowledge, right? But then we come to the gun industry, and we know that a number of crimes get committed, partly right now, from the glamorization of gun violence. And this is partly, I think, the marketing of the gun industry. But I also put quite a bit of blame on Hollywood and pop culture and the kind of movies we've made.
And I would imagine you would also argue video games, too.
Video games, too. But I think even Hollywood, the movies, more than the video games, and this is an area in which we know that this is, Hollywood. You watch the Academy Awards, and this is really overwhelmingly like liberal democratic influenced, and they're making most of their money. Like a lot of the top shows for the past two decades have been very violent movies. And so there's deep hypocrisy in that industry over what they between what they celebrate and how they make their money. And so I think that all of these things are, you know, all these people and organizations have overlapping areas of responsibility.
Before we close on this topic, I wanted to just sort of touch on the last segment that the Times had when they talked to these teens. Many argued that parents have a responsibility to take a child's signs of emotional distress seriously. And they said that the conviction in this case could serve as a wake-up call for other families who have a teenager in distress. And I do wonder that, I think that could be true. Because you can think of a situation where a parent is sort of not sure if what these signs should be taken seriously. And yeah, I'm sure many parents are motivated for the well-being of their child, the well-being of, you know, the people who are around their child. But goodness knows, if it takes the threat of sending them to prison for a period of time that will, in this case, the Crombleys learn in a couple of days now, that seems like an okay message to send, to say to these parents, you don't want your son to do this, and goodness knows you don't want to be held responsible for these actions. Do you think this could, in some at least small way, help discourage some of these actions in the future?
I don't know, and I think for one thing, it's really hard to tell sometimes, like, what are genuine signs of distress and what are the signs that would lead to serious harm on the child, towards the child, him or herself, or others. This is the thing. We have a lot of suicides right now, you know, a rising number among teenagers and even adolescents. I certainly don't want to say anything that would suggest that parents ought to feel really guilty about this if they don't recognize the signs. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think that's really hard, and we're raising children in an environment in which we see these numbers going up. We're not exactly sure what's going on. We have some indication, but it's really hard to tell what is just talk and what's really serious, and when we pay attention to it and when we don't, and then what to do as a result, right?
And I suppose there's the possibility that this could also cause parents to overreact, right?
Yeah, and you don't want that either, right? What makes the Crombley case different is that they've given their child the means to inflict serious harm on others. And when you do that, you have to take it even more seriously. And so just lock the gun up, right? That's what makes the difference in this case. So it's one thing if he's, you know, having these thoughts. It's another to say, and here's a handgun, and you know,
do with it what you will.
Do with it what you will, and we're just going to ignore anything you say about, you know, your anxieties or your troubled thoughts, and just hope for the best. I mean, that's where I think the jury made the right call in this case.
Well, and I would imagine too that, I mean, unfortunately, this was not the first time we've had a school shooting. But I would imagine that's why prosecutors in this case saw an opening, because this certainly seemed to be a more provable case, and ended up being quite provable, of negligence than many other cases in the past. Because I'm sure this had probably been considered by prosecutors in the past about, you know, holding the parents responsible. But this one seemed like a much stronger case than others.
Right. Yeah. And so... and the thing that makes it strong also makes it questionable whether it really serves as a marker of a new trend in holding parents responsible. I think it's very difficult. Well, as I've already said, like, responsibility is shared, you know, and how we judge that. When we're thinking about ethical responsibility, we can say, yeah, I mean, you have, as a parent, you have this ethical responsibility to do the best you can for your child, but also, like, for the community in which you live, because you're raising a child within a community to be a participating member of society. And so you have that kind of ethical responsibility, but the law doesn't really have much to say about that, right?
It probably shouldn't.
Probably shouldn't. But We want the law to try to prevent the very worst things from happening, but not to micromanage, you know, our lives or our relationships. The first time that the difficulty of these kind of negotiating the role of a parent and shared responsibility with children, the first time it really came home to me and my wife was when our child was 4 years old and attending a preschool, and we got a call from the principal that our son and some other boys had been throwing rocks over a fence that was on the surrounding their playground. And unfortunately, our son won the contest. He was able to get a rock over the fence and onto the windshield of a car that was parked right just on the other side of the fence, which he couldn't see, like mm-hmm. because the fence was taller than they were. They were just trying to get rocks over the fence. But he broke this windshield. We came to school. We had to find out who the car belonged to. There was an office building next door, and it belonged to somebody who worked in the office building. So we brought our son, you know, 4 years old, and he had to apologize to the woman who owned the car. But we had to write the check for the windshield, yeah. right? Like, we didn't feel like responsible in one sense for breaking the windshield, but he's our son. And so, like, we have extended responsibility because he did it, right? And I don't even know if we would be legally responsible for replacing the windshield. I didn't even bother to ask that question. It just seemed like the right thing to do. I knew, my wife and I, talking over, knew that it was really important for our son that he make the apology for his actions. Part of becoming responsible is that you take responsibility even in cases where you aren't, you maybe don't have to, right? And so learning how to do that. And this is an example, like, there's all these occasions in parenting where you kind of figure out gradually how your children take responsibility for things that are, in some ways, are a stretch for them, because in that case, he had the ability to throw the rock over the fence, and I'm not even sure if he knew that he could do it. He was trying with the other kids, and he didn't know it was on the other side, but it's an important lesson. Like, there are things that you do in life that have consequences, sometimes good and sometimes really bad for other people, and when you do things that have those consequences, you try to make amends, and this is what I thought. It was a really important, informative lesson for them, even though, like, I wished it hadn't happened because it ended up costing us a lot of money.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my very hypothetical question for you. Through some odd and unexplainable set of circumstances, you, Rick Kite, have the final official say on whether TikTok should continue to be made available to U.S. consumers. What would be your decision?
My decision would be, I think, pretty much in line with what I perceive as being debated right now, that TikTok, the U.S. version of it, whatever U.S. citizens be allowed to use, must be owned by a U.S. company. But they could not continue to use it if it were owned by China.
Though, again, things could change. It's been passed by the House. It's not been taken, as of this recording at least, the U.S. Senate hasn't taken action on it. Obviously, the U.S. Senate may revise the current bill that the House passed, but the bill the House passed in pretty bipartisan fashion was that once this passes and is signed into law by the president, would require the company, would put the company on a six-month clock to sell to an approved U.S. company.
Right.
And clearly, this would be a multi-billion-dollar sale. I mean, TikTok has a huge user base. And the number of U.S. companies that could write that check is a really small number of companies.
Yeah. But the big concern, well, there's two major concerns with TikTok. But one is about TikTok in particular, and that is the threat of information about U.S. citizens being
data.
The Chinese government having access mm-hmm. to that data, but also the ability for them to manipulate both social and political, social attitudes and then political decisions through all kinds of propaganda on TikTok. So it's a propaganda platform for the government, basically, to interfere with U.S. elections and U.S. culture.
Or, and, you know, obviously, hypothetically, if China, as many think is quite possible, may invade Taiwan in the future, what happens about that? And obviously, that would be a cultural discussion going on, and how would TikTok handle that? I think we probably know. And in there was a piece a couple of weeks ago that Matt Iglesias wrote saying he compared it to what if in the 1970s the Soviets made an offer to buy CBS? What would we have said?
I think we would have, without hesitation, said no.
And I shouldn't say the Soviets, but a Soviet company.
Soviet company or anything in the Soviet bloc, right? Any company owned in that. It wouldn't have even been a debate. Mm-hmm. That's what I find so interesting about this. Why is there a debate over this?
And I generally, I'm you know, you folks may remember that at our prediction show a couple of years ago, I predicted by the end of 2023 that this would indeed happen. And I was wrong. But
you should have been right.
And we'll see what happens this year. I've thought a little bit about this and read a few things. And again, generally, I'm on your side. The only real questions I have or concerns I have, I guess, are one, that it does give the president, in right now that's Joe Biden, and Joe Biden will be president forever, the ability to decide who one of these approved companies is. And the U.S. Justice Department often thinks that our technology companies are getting too big and too powerful, but yet the people who have the money and the wherewithal to operate a company like TikTok is pretty small. And so, you know, and I can't imagine that, like, Meta would be able or permitted to gobble this up, as that would just make them even bigger than they are, and that would seem to be some regulatory issues. But I don't know. I just wonder who that place would be. And then the other, I guess, concern I have is, I'll just pick an example here. And it's one that's been kicked around, is Microsoft, right? That Microsoft is a large tech company. They aren't really in the social media sphere. They clearly have the cash reserves to make a play on this. They have the technical ability to run something like this. And you might think, oh, great. I mean, and, you know, no company's perfect, but, you know, they have a pretty decent image. What could possibly go wrong? But then I wonder, let's say that they do business in China, right? That's a pretty big customer of theirs. And what would stop China from saying, hey, we're going to not want to do business with you anymore unless you take down or de-emphasize this content? And I don't know what you do about things like that, but I mean, I don't know if you remember, was it in 2019 maybe? There was an NBA player who put out a like kind of anti-China tweet, mm-hmm. and like people just went crazy, and the NBA took it, made him take it down, and like...
Well, wasn't there a game canceled?
Yeah, there was a game canceled. There was, I think, the team in Houston, Rockets.
The Rockets, yeah.
And all that around, like, a really small tweet. And so I just worry that if this were to happen, whoever does ultimately control TikTok, if it's a company that's doing business with China, I don't know, are they still going to feel some of that pressure anyway? I mean, the good news, though, of course, is that if it's Microsoft, as my example, you can bring in the CEO of Microsoft in a congressional hearing and make him or her answer questions and kind of make their case into to the lawmakers.
Listen to what you're saying. China always already has a history of putting a lot of pressure on American companies.
Yes.
To conform with their expectations and their rules.
Yes.
But we don't do that to Chinese companies, and you're saying we shouldn't, because then they might do it even more. I think, like, they do that all the time because they're protecting their national interests.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should do the same thing when it comes to serious concerns about our national security. And this, I think it's a national security concern. And so I'd say, like, well, yeah, there might be repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have ideal relationships with China right now. But that even makes the case stronger, I think, while we should like take measures to secure our national interest.
And then the one last thing that I'll just mention that I sort of skipped over that's an important step is if this were to pass the Senate and the House, and if Joe Biden were to sign into law, and he indicates that he, at least in its current form, would, that the very next minute, this lawsuit will be filed to try to stop this. And there are some who have, I think, somewhat legitimate concerns about the government overstepping about who can operate and, you know, when you have freedom of speech issues. And yes, I mean, it's quite widely known that things like Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat, et cetera, are not available in China. And are we, and us, and people would say, so sure, we should make or allow TikTok to be available in the U.S. But I mean, aren't we supposed to have like a more open society than China? Aren't we supposed to have more freedoms than the Chinese government allows its people? I mean, I'm just not sure saying, well, that's the way China operates, so that's the way we should operate is great, because China does a lot of stuff pretty poorly. And I just wonder, and again, neither of us are constitutional experts, but I think there's at least a case to be heard about whether this passes constitutional muster.
Well, I'm concerned about that too, but I'm more concerned from looking at how TikTok, already its algorithm is a black box to us. We don't know how it operates.
Correct.
But we know it does filter some things. It does suppress speech, right? And so I have more of a First Amendment concern over allowing a company that is run to some extent, takes its orders from another government, that puts speech restrictions on our own citizens. And so that seems to me to be an even greater concern than the question of whether we allow it to operate here. I think, you know, anything that in effect functions as a very large media company where its criterion for what it allows and what it doesn't allow is not at all transparent, I don't think it has very strong First Amendment claims on being allowed to operate here.
And so, I mean, it sounds like that this was not an especially difficult, you know, again, we made up a scenario where you're somehow the final arbiter here, but this doesn't seem like an especially difficult call for you.
Well, it's difficult for two reasons. One is that the way that China and Russia and some other countries are depicting this as this is a proposed ban on their company, and I don't think that's not what we're talking about. It's not simply a ban on that company. But the other thing that makes it difficult is the general concern of the effects of social media and especially TikTok on adolescents and on the development of them. That's another concern. And I think we need to have some government regulation of social media to protect our young people. But anything that we do in that regard should apply to social media more broadly. It may end up having a different kind of effect on TikTok than some of the other, like an Instagram or Facebook or something. But that's another question. That's a separate question, I think. And it's something that we ought to be debating in Congress right now.
And again, I kind of push back against you a little bit. If I somehow had the odd and unexplainable power to do this, I think I would, with a little more reluctance, make the same decision you have. I would just worry about some of the unintended consequences, about, you know, making already large, influential American companies even more large and more influential. And I think competition in this space is lacking. And I think that's one thing that TikTok has done well, is it has added competition. Unfortunately, of course, this would be a whole different story if this was some startup out of the Silicon Valley, not some startup from deep inside China.
So to summarize, you would do it but feel bad about it, and I would do it and feel good about it. Is that kind of...
I don't know if I'd feel bad. I would feel wary. I would just worry. I would just worry about what I'm on. What the? Because I don't think to any. If I think anyone that can tell you how this would play out, who might buy it, would it go away? I think it's just hard to know what the outcome necessarily would be. And I think thankfully neither of us are or likely ever will be in the position to have to make that final call.
That's probably a good thing.
But, dear listener, what you can make the final call about is you can subscribe to The Ethical Life, and I promise you that we are not a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese government. And if you want to do that, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Also, be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and this particular column is specifically about many of the issues we talked about in the beginning of this show. The Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rotta. Thank you for joining us.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.